case number 18-5276, Ian Ray to the Natural Education of Jason Leopold to instill certain electronic surveillance application board. Jason Leopold is the United States Senator. He stands in for balance. He's just made for an athlete.
Ms. Townsend.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This case presents issues of first impression for the circuit with profound implications for the public's ability to monitor the judicial branch and the executive branch.
That's two first impression cases in one day. We're batting 1,000.
The Stored Communications Act and the Pen Register Act, Titles 2 and 3 of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, contain provisions that enable law enforcement to seize private electronic communications records if appropriate or applicable legal standards are met. Critically, those statutes require ex ante judicial approval as well as judicial oversight. The judicial records that are central to the court's oversight role under the Stored Communications Act and the Pen Register Act, including applications filed by the government, court's dockets, and court orders themselves, are as a matter of law, presumptively open to public inspection under the common law as well as under the First Amendment. Yet the reality is that these judicial records are not only sealed initially while an investigation is active, but they are kept under seal often indefinitely, long after any rationale or reason for sealing has long since dissipated. The secrecy is not the product of statutory mandate.
Can I interrupt for a second? I think the hardest thing I found about this case is understanding exactly what happened in the district court and exactly what you're asking for.
I agree with you entirely, particularly the latter point.
Right, so if I could, I'm going to start with the former point and then I'll get to the latter point. So will you tell me if I'm correct? I want to focus only on the common law just for the moment. So on the common law right of access, am I right in saying that the district court held with respect to what we are calling retrospective, that is, materials that are currently sealed, there's no retroactive common law right of access at all, and thus, whatever you got before may be gravy, but there's no additional access to anything. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Right.
And with respect to prospective issues, which I understand to be documents which have not yet been filed, but will be filed after whatever decision is reached. Is that correct?
That's correct,
what prospective means? There's a limited prospective common law right to certain information. There's no right to closed case, that is, I'm going to call them closed case. I know they're closed investigations, but mm-hmm. I need a shorthand. Or even open, obviously, certainly not open, but not closed record documents, redacted or otherwise.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the rationale was administrative burden.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And the court will provide biannual reports of limited information, that is the information covered in the MOU.
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. And there's no real time or access to closed case to dockets, nor access to dockets after the case is closed, to the docket sheet itself.
That is correct, Your Honor, unless the matter is unsealed for some other reason. There are instances, for example, one-off instances where the U.S. Attorney's Office may request unsealing of a particular matter like this, or
what if you requested?
We have in fact done that in the past, and the media amici brief that was filed indicates some examples of instances in which members of the news media, including
so
the Reporters Committee, have it would appear to be foreclosed by the reasoning of the district court's ruling, because what the district court concluded is that there is no right of access. There is no common law presumption of access that attaches to these documents, because recognizing such a right would create undue administrative burden. So it's really, in our view, really either or. It's not a question of whether the right is overcome under given circumstances.
Right, I understand the argument. Let me get to the question that Judge Solon is concerned about and are interested in, as am I, which is sort of what you're actually asking and what happened below in relation to that. How, if at all, does what was given, the kind of information provided under the MOU, with respect to the biannual reports, how does that differ from the EDVA electronic docket that's been established? And I understand it's different between real-time access and biannual information, but with respect to actual information, what about that?
Setting aside the contemporaneous nature of the access to the EDVA docket, the information that's contained in the biannual reports, which are published every 6 months and contain sort of information about Penn Register Act and the Section and Stores Communications Act materials filed either 6 months or up to 12 months prior, it contains, and we provided and requested judicial notice and provided a sample, actually a sample of that report. It provides very limited information, not just the sort of the name of the matter. It does include the name of the matter, the judge that it was assigned to, as well as whether it is closed or open. But it does not indicate, for example, how the court ruled on the application. In other words,
does the EDVA one? I have a copy of the EDVA one. I don't see the rulings. Does it say how the court ruled?
It does not, and it is similar. The information that's provided by the EDVA is similar to the information that's provided in the 6 month reports, although it is not. Although it is not real time, although I will note this
which is not real time.
Reports are obviously.
Let me get to the bottom line. Is the EDVA good enough for you, or it's not good enough for you?
Well, I think the distinction between the EDVA, and I think this is highlighted in the Applebaum case as well, which is the Fourth Circuit that discussed the EDVA's docketing procedure.
I forget what that term refers to.
Pardon, Your Honor?
What is EVA?
Eastern District of Virginia.
Oh, is that what
electronic docket? Yeah, I'm sorry.
I apologize.
I'll call it the Virginia docket.
Virginia docket.
Yeah, that would help me.
That was addressed in the case that we refer to in the briefing as
I didn't read the Applebaum case.
That docket differs in the sense that not only is it real time, that's actually the docket. So in this case, we're not asking the court to create any dockets. Sort of the request that was made in the Applebaum case was for the docket to be expanded, to be matter by matter, and include sort of the actual filings in each case, as you would see on a civil or criminal docket. That is actually what the electronic dockets look like in the DDC for these types of matters. We just don't have access to those. So we're not asking the court to sort of create a new docket. In fact, the reports that are being created by the district court pursuant to the MOU, that's a new thing that's being created by the court.
I get all that. If you got what they get in the Eastern District of Virginia, would that be what you were asking for, or are you asking for more than that?
We are asking for more than that.
Explain what the more is.
I think it's critically important that not only does the public and the press have access, and even other magistrate judges around the country.
Just tell me what the specific things more that you want.
We would like access to the actual dockets that are maintained by the district court, the electronic dockets, as well as procedures that would provide for in what you call closed investigations or cases where the investigations are no longer ongoing, access to the underlying documents themselves.
Is that also your position with respect to the dockets? You're not looking for the dockets for live cases?
We had requested in our proposed order that we submitted to the court real-time docketing. The district court
In live cases.
The district court ruled that we had waived that argument by limiting our relief to post-investigation materials, but the district court did not separately address that issue, access to dockets even post-investigation. So to the extent that the district court, in fact, was correct that our relief is limited to post-investigation, we don't see why we are not entitled to post-investigation dockets.
Wait a minute. I lost you. Are you seeking dockets in live cases or not?
At this stage, Your Honor, we are asking this court to determine whether we have a right of access to these materials post-investigation.
Yeah, the answer is no.
Correct? No, Your Honor.
Yeah, no,
okay. Why don't you just say no?
All right, so this is what we're trying to see how the issues narrow or expand from our understanding. So the issue about the real-time docket with respect to open cases is not really before us.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so we're only talking about access to closed dockets. With respect to prospectively, we're only asking for closed docket information.
With respect to all the relief, Your Honor, post-investigation.
Yeah, I understand, but okay. And with respect to those, you're asking, well, I guess we would assume that a case that is filed today is open, right? That the investigation is still open.
I would assume that.
Yeah, otherwise, why get a pen register, right? Just as an example. Okay, so that would suggest some time lag before you'd have availability. So are you then saying within 6 months, or I can't remember what the amount of time you originally were proposing for an order to show cause. What was that? How much time was that?
180 days.
So you're, just to get clear, your request for prospective access to dockets and docket documents, you're talking about no sooner than 180 days. Is that right?
Not exactly, Your Honor. What we proposed to the district court was that the responsible U.S. attorney have the responsibility to unseal the matter once the investigation was closed. So that could happen sooner than 180 days. The 180 days is a backstop.
Okay, I understand. But again, to be clear then, for prospective relief, you're only asking for the question is, do you have a right to access the closed case dockets and underlying docket information, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you recognize, I take it from your previous jousting below, that some redactions would be permissible for privacy purposes, law enforcement, protection of law enforcement, case investigation, even a related case, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. Is that right?
That's correct.
So, all right. Now, with respect to retrospectively, we don't want anything for warrants. You're done with warrants, correct?
That's correct. It was impossible, really, for the district court to even identify those documents based on the way that they were kept previously. So we recognize that there would need to be perspective. For SCA warrants or Stored Communications Act warrants, my apologies, only prospective relief.
Right. So we're talking only about pen registers, and Trep and Trace, I'm just going to call them pen registers so I don't have to keep saying both, and for 2703D orders. That's all we're now. With respect to the pen registers, you're, again, only talking about closed cases, but for those, you're not even asking for the actual documents, just for extracted information.
Correct.
Assume you would take the documents, but you're willing to accept just the extracted information, and therefore the redactions, that is, sensitive information for one reason or another could be redacted.
That's correct.
All right. And with respect to the 2703D orders, all you're asking for, again, only with respect to closed cases, is basic docket information, like the number, the USA versus without the name of the person, the, I guess, which magistrate was assigned to it, maybe the result, et cetera, right?
Correct.
That kind of information. Okay, so now I think I understand this. Now, so I have one question about the two kinds of law enforcement techniques. I understand the argument about pen registers and open access. What do you do, and therefore your argument is these are judicial records, there should be a presumption of open access, correct, with respect to pen registers, orders, and then because you can't understand an order without the application, et cetera. All right. Now, what about the problem of 3123, which specifically provides that a pen register order shall direct that the order be sealed unless otherwise ordered by the court. Mm-hmm. Even if that doesn't reverse the presumption, doesn't it eliminate the presumption of access? That is, it begins with the conception that it will be sealed. And I appreciate that's not the case for warrants, not the case for 2703D, mm-hmm. which you distinguish. But at least for pen registers, how do we, and again, only on a common law, how do we get, how do you get to the argument that there's a presumption of access, that is of unsealing, when the statute says it'll be sealed unless otherwise ordered? That's sort of the opposite of a presumption. The normal way in which you would put a presumption is it would be unsealed unless the court ordered sealed.
I think the until further ordered by the court language actually contemplates future unsealing.
I understand that. This is a point that I think neither side has really briefed very well. I apologize for saying this, but I think this is the case. Everything's been merged, got three different kinds of things. We talk about them all together. Mm-hmm. It's definitely the case, I think, that it contemplates possibility of being unsealed, and therefore it contemplates you bringing motions for unsealing and for a decision, which the district court has to have a rational basis for resolving, otherwise it's an abuse of discretion. But when you talk about the presumption, it seems like you don't have the presumption there in the way that you have in a situation where there's no statute at all.
Well, I would say, Your Honor, I think it's quite useful, the case that was cited, in reapplication of New York Times for access to wiretap materials that was actually cited by the government on Friday in this Rule 28J letter is somewhat helpful, I think, in this regard because it demonstrates the difference between the sort of three titles of ECPA and how Congress sort of addressed sealing in each one. So if you look at the language of the Wiretap Act, which is the language that was at issue in that case, that language of that provision provides for sealing of the application, wiretap applications and orders, period. So there's no until for order, further order of the court, it's period. And then it goes on to say that those materials will be made available only upon a showing of good cause, which was interpreted by the court in that case to be quite limited and exclude members of the press and the public. Now, the Wiretap Act...
So that seems to completely reverse the any kind of presumption of access.
And that is what the Second Circuit held in the New York Times case. Right. That was cited.
I'm not asking about reversing. I think you're somewhere in between. It's to be sealed, unless a specific showing, and it doesn't say anything about it, in which case you get the presumption. You're in the middle. It says it'll be sealed unless the district court decides otherwise. Mm-hmm. Now, actually, this could be thought of two different ways. One is it's in the complete, unreviewable discretion of the district court. Doesn't even give a standard, like good cause. It would be unusual for us to assume district courts can act without any standard, unless it's quite clear. So that suggests there does have to be some standard. I don't know, good cause seems like a good standard. I guess we can think of another set of words, but at a minimum, there would have to not be an abuse of discretion. But that again suggests that the burden is on person wanting disclosure, not on the court to disclose automatically.
I think the standard, Your Honor, is the common law presumption. I think that's what Congress intended. I think that Your Honor's decision in MetLife Incorporated is actually very instructive on this point, because the Congress is presumed to be aware of the existence of the common law presumption of access, which is predates the Constitution in this country. It is presumed to be aware of that. And so if it indicates that matters can be unsealed upon order of the court, I think it assumes, I think the appropriate assumption, unless Congress says otherwise, which it clearly has not done.
Well, MetLife is really, and all the cases in general, are our assumption that everything is open. We start with the idea that our records are open, and then we address the question of a district court in an unusual circumstance sealing it. Mm-hmm. That's not what this is about. Pen registers, we begin with Congress's direction that they be sealed. So I don't think MetLife gets you all the way there. And, of course, MetLife was, how does a different statute applicable to the executive branch apply to the judicial branch? Not quite the same. All right, I don't have any questions. Judge Tatum, what were you about to ask?
Can change the subject.
Oh, please. Yeah, please.
So I wanted to ask you about an aspect of the common law argument here. If I were to agree with you that the district court erred by taking account of the administrative burden in the question of defining the common law right, what do you think about the? I have two questions about that. Number one, what do you think about the magistrate judge's argument that or point that? Well, the district court could take that into account in fashioning a remedy. That is, it could take account of administrative burden in terms of determining how and when you would get the documents. Are you okay with that?
I think the magistrate judge's argument that the appropriate consideration for administrative burden is determining how best to sort of facilitate access if a right exists is a very good approach.
Okay, you're okay with that. And second, again, this is a hypothetical. if I would agree with you about that we have to send that the consideration of the administrative burden was an error, and we send this back, do we even need to address the First Amendment issue? In other words, is there anything that you want that you can't get with the common law right and that you need the First Amendment right for, referring to the list you and Chief Judge Garland just negotiated? Anything on that list?
That may be an overstatement. <can't get? laughs>
It is unusual for the court to reach the First Amendment questions that are presented if the common law resolves the issue.
Yeah,
that said,
right.
This court in Washington Post against Robinson did right, suggest right. because of the different yeah. and heightened standards yeah. of protection that the First Amendment right of access
sure.
provides, that in some cases it is appropriate for the court to reach the First Amendment.
I know, but what about this case?
I think because of the nature of the remedy that we've requested. I mean, we are very cognizant of the fact, as the amici federal magistrate judges pointed out, there are different ways that the district court can facilitate this kind of access.
I understand that, but just answer my specific question. Is there anything you can't get under the common law right that you need?
If we
reverse the district court on the and say you can account for administrative burden in the remedy, What's left? Just tell me that. So, I mean, I understand exactly why you would want the First Amendment issue decided. I get that. But do you need it in this case?
I think because of the nature of the relief that we seek and the fact that, which is remand to the district court to apply the appropriate standards, I think if the district court does not have guidance on whether or not the First Amendment right of access applies to any or all of the materials at issue here, that could affect the remedy that the court does.
So that's
the
a prediction
the
about
provide.
How the district court might react. But
right.
I think Judge Tittle is asking this question. In your view of
right.
the common law,
yeah.
if your view of the common law were upheld by the district court,
right.
would you get everything you're asking for?
Practically, I think that is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
I think that answer.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate your candor. Of course, if you didn't, you could always return to the First Amendment issue. But for purposes of our thinking now, we don't. If we think, well, we've made the point. But that was my only question.
All right, I have a question. Why do you take the position that the burden is not a relevant factor to consider in determining the rights in the first place, as opposed to the remedy? Although, as a practical matter, if it's considered at the remedy stage, it may make no difference. But why do you say it's an illegitimate consideration, which is your basic legal argument on the common law? What is your ground for concluding that the government's burden is not a legitimate factor?
This court's precedent, Your Honor. I think if you look at El Saeed, United States against El Saeed, which defines judicial records and concludes that if items are judicial records, then the strong common law presumption of access applies to them.
I thought it was Hubbard that you really went back to.
And United States v. Hubbard.
And Hubbard actually is a case in which the government's interest isn't even involved. And Hubbard and the six factors in Hubbard are dicta, really. They weren't part of the holding. Back in the days when we used to write these expansive legislative-type opinions. But I don't see any reason why the burden or the government isn't relevant when we're talking about the common law.
Well, I would make 2 points.
I mean, the common law, we're supposed to consider all factors. We're free to consider factors. And there's not, even if you look at Hubbard, Judge Wald left open the question of new factors.
Well, I would say 2 things to that, Your Honor. I think Hubbard draws a distinction between the 6 generalized factors, which this court has recognized has always served as a sort of the lodestar for determining whether the presumption.
You mean that legislation we passed?
He means the one that 3 subsequent cases adopted as the holding. That's the ones he's talking about.
The generalized factors in Hubbard, the 6 generalized factors, are those factors that the court identified could be balanced in determining whether the right, not whether it exists, but whether it's overcome in a given case, Those are the six factors that can be considered without reference to the documents, to the contents of particular documents.
But it didn't exclude other factors.
It provided for particularized factors.
That opinion actually did not exclude other factors.
I would have, particularly in Hubbard, where the number of records that were at issue in Hubbard ranged, I believe, in excess of 23,000 records, I would have thought if the court in Hubbard wanted to treat administrative burden as a generalized factor that a court could look at or determine or weigh without even looking at the contents of records, it would have included that within the generalized factors. The particularized factors, which Hubbard allows for, are factors that the court that must be tied to the contents of specific records.
Well, I'm trying to say the government was not involved. The government's interest was not at stake in Hubbard.
That's true, Your Honor. It involved a private party who was moving.
So when we're talking about the common law, we didn't even have to look at, in that case, the implications of a burden on the government. So I that's why I'm inclined to think it doesn't exclude the concept of burden. Now, to be sure, if the district judge in fashioning a remedy, assuming there's a violation, can come out the same way as she would in determining whether or not the burden is a relevant factor in determining whether the common law applies in the first place, that may make no difference. But I'm very troubled at the proposition that burden is an irrelevant factor.
I think to burden with respect to requests to unseal is an argument that could be made or is present in every case. It certainly isn't the case that a district court could conclude, for example, that plea agreements, which this court has held are subject to a First Amendment right of access,
would be restricted. You know, it seems to me there's a big difference. There's one area, whether you're talking about plea agreements or you're talking about consent decrees, you're talking about final actions of a court. I think that's of the highest public interest.
The records at issue here do include court orders granting or authorizing.
No, I'm talking about the final actions of the adjudication of a substantive case, a consent decree, a plea agreement, etc.
Even in a case where
the argument can be made, this is much closer to a subpoena, to a grand jury subpoena, and we don't disclose those at all.
And I think, Your Honor, we addressed why these matters are distinguishable from grand jury matters, which are very unique, as this court recognized in the Henry Sealed case, and subject to really singular secrecy in our system, in our judicial system. And the reasons why in Henry Sealed case, which isn't decided under the common law or under the First Amendment at all, it was decided under Local Rule 6.1 precisely because of the sort of unique context of grand jury material. But I'd like to, if I may, Your Honor, I know I'm way over my time, go back to just the notion that you raised that if the court can consider administrative burden in sort of determining how best to provide access, that would not lead to a different outcome. And I think that I would disagree with that. I think that does lead to a different outcome. To the extent that administrative burden is not a factor that determines the existence of the right, and it's not a factor that can outweigh the right, let alone outweigh the presumption of access under the common law, then the way that it sort of
plays well, the point is
how
the burden can be taken into account. It isn't necessarily a question of is there a common law right or is there not, but it can be a modified common law right. You see what I'm driving at? The burden could be taken into account, perhaps, hypothetically, without a determination that there's no common law right. It could affect the common law right.
I think it could affect, it should not be taken into account to determine either the existence of the right or whether the right has, in a given instance, been overcome. I think where burden could be considered is in the district court's ability to determine sort of how best to give access, or whether a local rule, like the local rule in the District of Arizona that provides for a 180-day sunset period, like the one that we've suggested,
What about this case? What about the fact that to give you your remedy would take hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of government time? That's not relevant?
It wouldn't, Your Honor. I think
you're saying that it's not relevant.
No, I'm saying that as a factual matter, that was time that that was an estimate of time that the U.S. Attorney's Office provided with respect to a certain type of retrospective relief that we have asked for. And what we asked for was primarily prospective relief.
Yeah, given you said that changes, in your brief, primarily. But then I thought, but you do seek some retrospective relief.
Limited retrospective relief, yes, Your Honor.
And that's only dealing with what, the 2703D orders?
That's correct, and Penn Register Act matters.
And what?
And Penn Register Act matters, Penn Register matters.
Well, what are you seeking retrospectively?
Retrospectively, with respect to Penn Register matters, we are seeking unsealing of specific sort of information about those matters, including things that were filed, similar to what we called a sort of extraction process at the district court level, similar to what was provided for 24 of those matters from the year 2012 by the U.S. Attorney's Office. We're also asking retrospectively for basic docket information for Section 27.
So is the burden upon the government and the court system relevant at all in considering whether there's a common law, what the extent of the common law right is?
Not the extent of the common law. I think it is relevant in with respect to the court fashioning a remedy, but I don't think a court could say have a common law right of access to inspect, you have a common law right to inspect these docket sheets, but because it would be burdensome for you to exercise that right, we're going to foreclose access. I don't think that's the way burden can be interpreted.
Foreclose access is an overstatement. In other words, I'm looking for whether if burden is a relevant factor in articulating what the common law right is.
I don't think it is, Your Honor. I don't think Hubbard contemplates consideration.
Well, Hubbard didn't deal with the problem. Hubbard didn't deal with the problem at all, and certainly didn't even have the government involved.
I would think that if burden would be a factor, that the courts would be concerned about burden on individual private parties as well as on the government.
And what about the burden on the court?
I think that burden, administrative burden, and I do think that the federal magistrate judge's amici brief is helpful in a couple of ways. One, by pointing out that the burden, especially prospectively, was overstated or overstated by both the U.S. Attorney's Office and the District Court, particularly given some of the changes that the District Court has already made, including standardizing case captions and providing standardized case captionings and providing electronic filing capability for the U.S. Attorney's Office. I think the burden is not quite as expansive as the District Court seem to think. I also think that to the extent that there are different ways that the district court can facilitate the public's right to inspect these documents, that would be less burdensome even than what we've asked for in our proposed order. I think to the extent the policies and the procedures comply with the common law presumption of access, that's fine. And I think that the court can consider administrative burden when shaping a remedy, but I don't think that administrative burden can be used as a factor under Hubbard, certainly not to define the existence of the right, but even to determine whether the right has been overcome.
Or if it's been modified.
I don't think that I think once...
There's nothing in Hubbard that precludes that, is there?
A modification of
the common law right is modified by the burden.
I think that the structure that this court's precedent sets forward is sort of this two-step structure. This does the common law presumption apply? And if we're talking about judicial records with meet the definition of judicial records, the common law presumption applies. Then the question is the right overcome in a given case by the factors that the court identified, the generalized factors, and any particularized factors that speak to the document's contents, is the right overcome? So that test doesn't contemplate administrative burden in either identifying whether the right exists or even what the scope of the right is. I think we're not insensitive to the administrative burden concerns that were raised, and in fact, I think if you look at the way that the case proceeded at the district court level, I think we voluntarily narrowed our retrospective relief we sought in order to ease some of what the U.S. Attorney's Office asserted was a burden on them to comply with wholesale unsealing. We understood that. We didn't ask for that. We moved towards what we thought was far more important and really necessary, which were changes to the policies and procedures for docketing and unsealing these matters. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Hear from the United States.
May it please the Court, Peter Smith on behalf of the United States.
Mr. Smith, can I just make sure my description of what the district court held, which the plaintiffs agree was an accurate description, do you agree that was an accurate description as well?
I agree with that, yeah.
Thank you.
For a period of approximately 2 years, the parties in the district court worked through these issues. The district court's decision concerning the common law right of access was a reasonable compromise given the various factors that it was required to balance.
Counsel, since I'm a little bit more sympathetic to your position than my colleagues here, let me say, so there's one thing in your brief that troubled me no end, and that is the notion that some of the material that would be disclosed if the plaintiffs in this case prevail, the appellees, would alert people as to what techniques the Justice Department is using for investigative purposes. You did make that argument.
We did. If
and I yeah. find that troubling, because that seems to me exactly what the Reporters Committee and plaintiffs are entitled to have. I recognize that could diminish the effectiveness of certain techniques, but it seems to me the common law right of access overweighs on that. I don't think you can hold back your techniques for purposes of effectiveness.
I understand Your Honor's point, and I think that regardless, that what the district court did was correct, and that the government's arguments in this case don't rise or fall based upon that component of its argument. For example, today appellants were arguing that they want the unsealing of, I understood them to be saying all of these documents after a certain period of time, and
with redactions, they said.
Right, with redactions, and that raises a variety of different issues.
Well, let me ask another point along the lines of Judge Silverman's, which bothered me more than the question of the techniques, and that is the government's theory of the burden of proof the government must present in order to get approval by the court. The district court mentioned that also as something that should not be disclosed. It seems to me that a magistrate's order approving it, even if we don't know what kind of electronic surveillance it is on a government theory, this was the difference between probable cause and whatever the lesser version
was. Right, the reasonable suspicion.
Yes. Do you see any reason why the public should not know that the government is urging the court to adopt a reasonable suspicion standard rather than a probable cause standard?
Is
that something that should be redacted in your view or not?
The standard that's being applied by
yes,
the court in adjudicating
yes.
I think the theory of the district court and the government in making that argument was that it would telegraph to someone what sort of order it is, meaning is it a 2703A warrant or is it a 2703D
Well, what's
order?
The difference with respect to, I don't see what the government's law enforcement interest is in parties, in the public at large knowing, assume for the moment they don't even know what kind of electronic surveillance it is, just that it fits under one of these statutes. But I see a big concern about public access to the standards that district courts and magistrates are using. That's the court's order.
I understand.
What if the court ordered, we're going to uphold this conviction because it's more likely than not? Because that would be good for law enforcement. I mean, we're not going to tell anybody. That doesn't seem right.
I think I'm agreeing with the court's point.
Okay.
The memorandum of understanding that the clerk's office has adopted and the district court is implementing, I believe, contain, and I can check very quickly, but I believe contains the statutory authority for the government's request. So I think that the public is receiving that information in future cases. And as I mentioned, the government and the district court had reasons for making that argument, but I think I agree because I think going forward, the public is receiving that information. And that dovetails with my argument before that what the district court did here in implementing the six-month delay in implementing the memorandum of understanding, which provides appellants with a lot of information, much more than the Virginia docket provides, was not only a reasonable compromise, but it was a proper legal conclusion.
So the latter is really the issue. I don't think there's any doubt here that the district court has done tremendous work on creating transparency that did not exist before in the dockets, and that this was very hard work to get done. I don't think there's any doubt about that, and I think that's an extremely important improvement. The question is whether, under the law, the plaintiffs are entitled to more, not whether a compromise is sufficient. We don't normally compromise like this. We do balance.
Right.
So I'm concerned on the question of the burden. And so if I could ask you a few specific questions about that. So with respect to the pen register matters, the court, taking the court's worst case, the court said it would take nearly 20 40-hour AUSA work weeks to get the retrospective information. That's the top of the district court's estimate.
Correct.
Okay.
788 hours, I think she said.
Right, which came down to 20 40-hour work weeks. So if you... And the court said, as a consequence, you're not entitled to anything, correct? That burden meant that there was no right of access at all for the closed cases, the pen registers.
So I disagree with that, or at least the way that you framed it, Judge Garland. I think that what the district court said or did in the order was to say that there is a limited common law right of access, and it is no more extensive than the materials that appellants have already received.
Which were a sort of a sample subset of information.
Correct.
Correct. Okay.
So it was 10% of all those materials.
Right. And that's all they get a right to, 10% randomly chosen, not the rest. Of, I don't even know how they were chosen, but
right.
10%. Okay. So if you put five people on it at the U.S. Attorney's Office, that would only take 4 weeks, correct? I just divided. That's all I did.
I think, and I would also add to this, I mean, the burden is also on the district court.
Well, that's not the way. The district court did say that with respect to the 2703D docket, but not the estimates with respect to the pen register information was with respect to the AUSA work weeks. So if you put five people on it, that would only be 4 weeks. If you did it over 2 years, that would only be 2 weeks. If you did it over 3 years or 5 years, what is the justification, whether you regard the balancing as the question of the existence of the right or the remedy, for saying you can never, even in 100 years, get access to that retrospective information? I don't understand that. I understand why, in the words, I think, of the magistrate's brief, you know, the how and the when, but not the ever, not the existence at all. What is the justification for a rule that says, because we can't give it to you today, because it would take, I don't know, the whole U.S. Attorney's Office, we can't give it to you after 2 years, or
right.
We can't put some extra people on it, or something like that?
I think that the answer is the balancing process itself. The fact that burden can be part of the balancing process is expressed by cases like Nixon, the Supreme Court's case Nixon, for example, that says that the district court has discretion in light of the relevant facts and circumstances.
Every one of those cases have to do with a specific set of documents.
Correct.
None of them have to do with an entire class of documents.
Right.
So under your rule, if I understand correctly, pen registers are judicial records subject to the presumption of access in Virginia and in maybe six or seven other districts, because there isn't a huge burden and there aren't a lot of them, and they are not judicial records subject to presumption in the District of Columbia. That seems like an odd rule for a category of documents, doesn't it?
Well,
is
I guess
your position that are not judicial records?
No, we agree they're judicial records. And as I said before, I think to the extent that appellants have a right to the materials, that right was defined by the 10% they received. So I would disagree a little bit.
Other than 10%.
Right. With what
happy to put it that way.
Right.
But so imagine that in our circuit, in the days before PACER, where everything is done by paper, it's a huge burden on us to produce for a newspaper who wants to come and look at our briefs and appendices. I mean, we'd have to put on, you know, many, many more people in the clerk's office to do that. That's a big burden. And, you know, imagine some other circuit that, well, I guess we're the smallest circuit. So imagine some other circuit with some huge circuit with a big burden, like the Ninth Circuit. They'd have to put people on in every courthouse. So can it be the case that briefs and appendices are judicial records subject to the presumption of openness in our circuit, but not in the Ninth Circuit?
I would think so, based upon the burden, because I think burden is a proper it's a proper mode of analysis for the district court to engage in, and B, because you'd have to look at the burden against the other interests that are being weighed. And that's why I was saying before, you know, compromise may be the improper term that I used when I was starting out, but the bottom line is that this was a proper balancing of these different interests.
So we've never said that about those kind of things, and we've never considered, for example, with respect to our appendices and briefs, which were the subject of MetLife, that we would think about how many people it took. You know, it takes a lot of court personnel to keep this proceeding open right now. And in a trial, it takes a lot more. It takes United States Marshals. It takes people from the Bureau of Prisons, from the D.C. jail. It's way more expensive and way more time-consuming than the 40 hours that we're talking about here.
Right. So I guess.
And yet, could you say that some trials are open because no burden, and some trials, really the really controversial ones, because those are the ones where there's a huge line outside, and we need a lot of court personnel. Those are closed because the burden on the court or on the U.S. Attorney's Office or on the Justice Department's Marshal Service is too big?
Well, I think the balancing process would also be affected by what sort of record it is. So in your hypothetical, you're talking about a brief, you're talking about something that's more akin to, in the district court, the trial, the public proceeding that the public can attend. These materials are more akin to grand jury materials. They're criminal investigative materials. And the district court was balancing its interest. And this is
That seemed to be part of the First Amendment balancing, not in terms of the common law balancing.
I think this is also part of the common law balancing, and it's part of my answer to your question, Your Honor, which is that the district court's got to balance all these factors, and they include the law enforcement interest. You know, when you were saying before that this would be a certain number of hours or a certain number of weeks of a time for an assistant U.S. attorney or some other U.S. attorney's office employee, that the district court was properly weighing what else that person could do. And that seems like when you're talking about privacy interests, law enforcement interests, the integrity of open investigations, and the other law enforcement functions that the U.S. Attorney's Office has, that those are all reasonable.
No one disputed the question of the integrity of open investigations. The burden comes from figuring out which ones are open and which ones aren't.
Right.
But the plaintiffs are not disputing here or, I guess, below that open investigations shouldn't be disclosed, nor even that sensitive information shouldn't be disclosed. The only issue is how many bodies have to be put on the, correct?
Yes.
On the job to be sure that they aren't disclosed.
I thought you made an argument that, and this was an interesting one, that it's enormously difficult to determine whether the matter is totally closed, even if the case is closed. In other words, there could be spin-offs from the case in three different U.S. attorney's offices around the country, for all you know.
That's correct.
And the effort to determine whether there's no prejudice to continuing law enforcement purposes can be enormous.
It can. I agree with that. And we did make that argument in our brief. And the district court spent a fair amount of time unpacking that. How
can you just turn that into a number of hours. That's what's puzzling me.
Well, I think the number of hours is more of a discrete inquiry into extract. I think that was the calculation of how long it would take to extract information from the cases that the government agreed or thought were closed. But
yeah, but what about the time it takes to try to determine whether the matter is closed? And it's not just the case. That's what's so troubling me. It can be all kinds of spin-offs from the case.
I agree. I think that is a big problem.
And so is there any way you can even calculate that?
You can't, can you?
That's an imponderable.
No, I don't think you can. And I think that that also goes to the point.
Did you argue that you can't below?
Well,
I don't understand. The district court didn't say that it can't be calculated.
It said it was the district court didn't put a number of hours on that calculus, and it said it was very difficult
Well, you did it with respect to the 10%, right? She based her evaluation of the number of hours based on how many hours you represented it took on the 10%.
Yeah, I think that those were where the government had agreed that those cases were closed.
Right. Well, so.
So in other words, you're not even calculating how difficult it would be to determine whether a case is closed.
Yes, and I think that point and what I was just referencing.
That's what I got out of the brief.
Right. So I think that goes primarily to the forward-looking relief that appellants are requesting. So you have, they're requesting real-time docketing. They're requesting the unsealing after a certain time period of all cases or all matters, the presumptive unsealing. And so there, that problem is a huge problem.
But that was eliminated. They're not arguing about the real-time docketing anymore.
That's true.
With respect to the question of whether the government agrees it's closed or not, we're nowhere near that issue. We're only talking about cases where the government agrees it's closed. That is, at least I didn't read any part of the remedial request as being a right to dispute whether cases are actually closed or not.
Well,
we begin with the assumption that the government decides this is closed. And if you can't tell, then you can't tell. Then it's left as an open investigation some good faith on the part of the government is assumed. Of course, they can bring a request with respect to some specific case and dispute that. But I don't see anywhere in their proposal where they're arguing not only is there a right to access closed cases, but there's a right to dispute as a huge category what's closed. So I think, at least for my purposes, you should go along on the assumption that the government gets the benefit of doubt on whether it's closed. The government decides that question. And maybe someday somebody challenges that. But government's expected to do the best it can to decide if it's closed.
So we're not talking at all then about the burden on the government to make a determination as to whether the case is closed?
Well, I think we still are. So
you still would have to decide whether it's closed. But if you can't decide, then you can't decide.
Right. But I think that the request for relief implicates open cases. And I take your point that they seem to have abandoned the request for real-time docketing. But I heard appellants this morning still making the argument that after a period of time, everything should be unsealed. And I guess your point is only closed cases.
Yeah, so this is an element of the remedy that, A, we don't have to decide today, and that they really weren't asking us to decide. As far as I could tell from the brief, I will ask, of course, but my understanding of the request at the end of their brief is set out what the legal standard is, send it back to the district court, and let the district court then make determinations. I understand that one of their proposals is after 6 months, notice to show cause, order to show cause, et cetera. I don't think that level of granular detail, which I'm very grateful the district court is willing to address, but we don't have to address. And so I don't think we need to worry about that. If they demand something that the district court concludes would put investigations at risk, then the district court so holds, and they either appeal again or they're happy with what they got.
I understand the court's point, and I guess my response would be simply to urge the court that the burden on the district court and on the district court staff and on the U.S. Attorney's Office is a relevant and proper factor for the district court to have considered, not only at the remedy stage, but in the balancing process itself. And again, I would point the court to Nixon. Hubbard is implementing cases like Nixon. Hubbard didn't come out of thin air. It was...
I'm sorry, Nixon's the tape? Which case is
that? I think it's the case that's cited in the government's brief.
Yeah, yeah, I'm just remembering the facts. What were the facts in Nixon?
I think it is the access to the tapes.
Yeah, so it's a specific, you know, it's a specific document. It's not a, an entire category of everything.
Right, but I think that
it
what
is
that...
It is the tapes, right.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
What are you citing for? What proposition?
The proposition that the district court has broad discretion in light of the facts and circumstances to make its balancing. But to Judge Garland's point about that involved the specific materials, I would respond that here the district court has even more discretion because you have this sort of unprecedented request for wholesale unsealing. I mean, appellant said this morning this was unprecedented. This is a novel case. And to me, that gives the district court more, not less discretion.
The question is what?
Well, this may not be novel vis-a-vis other district courts.
There are other district courts that
have addressed. And if other district courts have given relief similar to what the plaintiffs are seeking here, then it's not so novel, is it?
Well, I'm not aware of any district court that has.
Okay, that's one question I was wanted to ask.
Is this unique to the District
Columbia Circuit?
And there's a California case in the district court that's cited by both parties that came out the same way. The requesters there, they wanted unsealing of large categories of information, and the district court rejected that. I'm not aware of any case.
Is it the same kind of pen?
Yeah, the same materials. This very similar to this case.
Stored communications pen and pen register?
Yes. So what I was going to say is that I'm not aware of any case that addresses this precise issue and has granted relief. There are addressing these criminal investigative materials like pen register, trap and trace, Stored Communications Act materials. There are cases that have granted relief and sometimes large, you know, cases that appellants have cited involving civil cases or docketing, but there's no case that involves criminal investigative materials where any court that I'm aware of has awarded relief of the sort appellants are requesting here on any basis, whether it's the First Amendment or the common law. The only cases that the parties have cited that are like this are this case and the case I mentioned from California, two district court cases where the appellants in that case did not get relief.
Quick question about docket sheets. Plaintiffs make clear they're only interested in docket sheets for closed cases, which they're only getting a sample of, right, under the MOU. Do I understand that? Is that right?
They would be getting, if they, you're saying historically, what have they gotten so far?
What would they be entitled to? Yeah, right, in closed cases.
Retrospectively, they've gotten extracted information in pen register and trap and trace, and they've gotten some
docket. I'm talking about the docket sheets.
And they've gotten just
the docket sheets.
Right. They haven't gotten any docket sheets, I don't believe.
So, and what's the government's position about those under the
Well, in addition to the burden, appellants have already said that they would be willing to redact. They don't want open cases, they want to redact personal information. So not only do you have the burden of obtaining those materials, which the district court pointed out, but I think during this process that the government and the district court and the appellants engaged in over the course of years, they determined that what would result after this material was redacted because of the form that it comes in wouldn't be that helpful to appellants. They wouldn't glean that much information from it. It wouldn't be that helpful. And the reason is in part because there was no standardized practice for the filing of these things until 2017 when the district court imposed electronic filing and all of these matters were then filed electronically.
Counsel, I want to go back to my try to buttress my understanding of your burden. You've agreed that with prospectively, every 6 months you would provide X information for the last 6 months, right?
Correct.
And 10%.
So what the district court is doing...
No, I'm asking what your position is. It is 10% of the relevant orders? What is the 10%?
The 10% is what the appellants have already received for the Penn Register and Trap and Trace materials, and it's extracting categories...
Is it retrospective or prospective?
Retrospective.
What is your prospective position for every 6 months?
Right, so our position is what the district court actually did, which is every 6 months to issue a report, the clerk's office would do that, and the report contains 7 categories of information for all of these contested materials. And that it's actually a very fulsome report. It contains, for example, the statutory authority, the statute that the government is investigating, the docket number.
And that is not 10%. That's everything.
That's everything. Right.
All right. I was a little confused about that.
Right. Going forward, and the reason for that is because starting in 2017 and continuing now, the government is electronically filing all of these materials with a standardized format.
What are you not giving then? Or is it because, which causes the controversy with respect to prospective? What are you, you're giving everything, are you giving everything every 6 months that the petitioner, that the plaintiffs want?
I understand them to be asking for the actual materials themselves, the documents, and what they are getting is basically a summary of docket information for all of the matters for the 6 month period. And like I said, there are 7 categories of information. So basically they're getting a summary, which the district court calls a report, issued every 6 months. But I understood them to be asking for the actual materials. And, you know, and there that implicates, I'm sorry, you're
up. Go ahead. I don't understand why that's a problem. Okay. Why is that a problem?
Right. So that implicates a burden beyond gleaning the information from the headings, but, you know.
Well, wait a minute. Well, I don't understand that. That would be easier than creating a report, wouldn't it?
Well, you'd have to get all the, you'd have to redact the information. So you couldn't just hand it out to the public. You'd have to redact it.
You'd have to look at every document.
Right. So that itself is an issue.
And then, what are you redacting? What is your agreement you're redacting for?
You're redacting for personal information and other case information that could implicate some sort of law enforcement interest.
You have so that obviously presents a burden to you, but you have no articulation of what the amount of that burden is.
We don't. It wasn't quantified in the district court. And then I would add Your Honor's point before that determining when a matter is closed is implicated there, and that is a big, I wouldn't just call it a burden, that's a big issue, because you've got to figure out whether the matter is open or closed, whether it's related to an open investigation.
How much of that do you have to do even for the 6 month report?
They are pulling public, we don't have to do that because they are pulling information that the parties and the district court have agreed is public, or could be made public already. So I guess I would say it's not a factor for the reports, but for anything beyond the report, it would be a factor. And then it would implicate all the things that Your Honor mentioned, like the district court specified, for example, or it mentioned, and we mentioned in our brief, that for the government to figure out if an investigation is closed, it's got to canvass the agents, it's got to find the assigned assistant U.S. attorney, it's got to track down parallel or spin-off investigations. It's really very difficult. So that was one of the reasons that the government had always opposed the imposition of this sort of time period where everything becomes public after
You mean a default?
Right, a default unsealing. And, you know, the character of these documents, it doesn't lend itself to that. You know, in Judge Garland's hypothetical before, these are more like the briefs that are filed on the docket are, you know, public records. They're part of more like the trial process of the appellate court, of this court. These materials are...
Your argument is these are like grand jury.
This is like grand jury material. This is investigative criminal material. And it goes back to the point before. No court has awarded the sort of relief that I am aware of. And the parties haven't identified any case where that is like this one, that's awarded appellants the relief that they're seeking.
Thank you. I know there's no time, but everybody's going over today, so we'll give you a couple more minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You might want to start by addressing that Lattner question.
I will. First, the district court opinion that the government cited, the Entry Granick decision, which is also cited in their briefing and addressed in our briefing, actually relied for the point of administrative burden on the district court decision that's on appeal here. So it's a bit circular for the government to point to that as a basis for reliance. There is, it is true.
That's not quite circular. It just means somebody else agreed with it.
It's true, Your Honor. There is only one Court of Appeals decision that addresses public access to any type of material, the Applebaum case, which any of the types of materials at issue here, the Section 2703D materials, which the court, the Fourth Circuit held the common law presumption of access does apply to, as we argue here. Just a couple of clarifying
points.
What
about my concerns?
I think my clarifying points will actually go to your concerns, Your Honor. This notion of determining whether or not a matter is open or closed and then the administrative burden purportedly associated with that, that was raised by the government at the district court with respect to old matters, so matters in 2012, 2013, matters that were older, where the U.S. Attorney's Office indicated that maybe the responsible attorney wasn't even there anymore, was no longer working with the government, and so it wasn't clear to them how the case had been resolved. I think with respect to the prospective relief that we've requested, which is effectively that the government attorney who's responsible actually move to unseal once the matter is closed, that would be addressed. And there's no automatic unsealing. I want to be sure that that's clear as well.
I don't understand. The attorney would move to unseal under your recommendation?
And that's consistent with what the U.S. Attorney's Office does in other criminal matters for other types of records. When a matter is sealed...
Never grand jury subpoenas.
No, Your Honor, and that's part of the reason why I think the grand jury's subpoena analysis, or analogy rather, is very inapt. It pulls from the Fourth Circuit's decision in Applebaum, but is irreconcilable with the Applebaum court's decision that these are judicial records subject to at least a common law presumption of access.
No, but okay, but here's the question. If what I'm concerned about is going forward, if you get the actual documents, the applications, the order, so forth, even redacted, right? You're assuming they're redacted, right?
I would assume so.
Don't you see that presents an enormous problem for the Justice Department and with respect to any specific case? They have to determine whether there's any spinoff on that case anywhere else, maybe in another U.S. Attorney's office?
I think with respect to the attorneys who are actually working on those matters, that actually wouldn't be incredibly burdensome. I can understand why it would be difficult to recreate
self-contained funnel, which only two or three lawyers are working on. But it may spin off into the Second Circuit or into the Ninth Circuit. And what do they do about that?
I would note, Your Honor, that I think that that's probably a very, based on the 6-month reports that we've actually seen from the district court, which do indicate when a matter is closed, it looks like most of the matters that are listed on these are, in fact, closed matters, which would suggest they don't last, the vast majority of these types of matters don't last more than 6 to 12 months. And so I think that while that may be the case, and maybe that is a compelling interest that overcomes the common law presumption of access and requires sealing in those particular matters for a longer period of time, I think we've allowed for that. I think that the prospective relief we recommend to the district court
Those are covered by the Hubbard factors, right? Aren't they? What you're now talking about, that's one of the Hubbard factors. The the strength of any privacy, interest in keeping it secret or sealed, right? That's not a burden question. That's the government's interest in protecting the information.
That's correct. That's okay. a Hubbard factor.
You don't disagree with that, right?
No, we don't disagree with the application of the Hubbard factors with respect to that.
But that's different from the administrative burden.
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Another interesting case. Thank you all very much for the presentations. We'll take it under submission.